From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Latino voters could be a decisive force in the elections. We'll talk about a new campaign to register 1 million Latino voters. And this week, President Clinton hailed the U.S.-mediated Israel-Lebanon Accord. We'll hear two views from Jerusalem.
They felt that Syria has the ability to turn these guerrillas on and off, and what they wanted to do was to demonstrate to Syria that there will be a heavy price if it continues allowing these guerrillas to operate.
And from Beirut.
All this bloodbath, which I've, as I say, had the misfortune of actually witnessing with my own eyes in the case of Kana, has not succeeded in getting Syria to do anything so exotic as leaning on the Hezbollah, and indeed has apparently produced the grotesque irony that all these people had to be cut down and killed, almost all of them civilians, so that Mr. Peres can get re-elected and thus bring peace to the Middle East. I am lost for words at such an equation.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Senator Alphonse D'Amato says Speaker Newt Gingrich and his House Republicans must moderate their message. If they don't, he predicts Bob Dole's presidential campaign will be damaged. D'Amato is co-chair of Dole's National Campaign Steering Committee. He says the House Republican agenda in the last session of Congress sent the wrong message. D'Amato says the people in 94 voted for evolution, not revolution. And the Republican Party is heading for a new battle over keeping a strong anti-abortion plank in its platform. This according to Pat Buchanan today. He says, if it is fought, we expect to go to the convention and win that battle. Buchanan said GOP presidential candidate Bob Dole could head off any attempt to have the right-to-life plank torn out of the Republican platform. Buchanan said, I simply would like to see him to come out and say, look, there's no reason to change that platform. And Colin Powell says politicians need to spend more time listening to people and less time raising money. Speaking in Columbus, Ohio, Powell said voters are turning to Ross Perot, Steve Forbes, and himself because politicians aren't listening. He said voters want new leadership dedicated to solving the country's problems. In a little while, we're going to be talking about foreign policy, particularly the situation in the Middle East. But right now, we look right here at home. An historic voter registration drive is underway to bring more than 1 million new Latino voters to the polls this November. As Latinos make up an increasing percentage of the U.S. population, both Republicans and Democrats are beginning to take Latino political power more seriously. We're joined by three guests around the country and my co-host in New York, Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Good morning, Amy.
Juan, before we go on to the Latino vote, just a quick comment on your piece today, which really follows up on our discussion Wednesday on Democracy Now! About Haiti.
Right. Yes, I had a column in the paper today that basically raised the whole issue of the 160,000 pages of documents that the U.S. Army illegally took out of Haiti. And as you recall, we were talking with Reed Brody, a human rights lawyer, earlier in the week, and I followed that up with a column basically reminding the general public that this is an illegal act by our government, and also basically laying out the reason why these documents could be so important, because there could be major revelations about our country's role during and after the overthrow of President Aristide contained in those documents.
It's interesting that here President Clinton is holding back these documents, about 100,000 of them, and Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole and his supporters like Jesse Helms have cut off some aid, or at least frozen aid, to Haiti because Haiti is not doing things according to what they would like to see. So Haiti's really caught in the middle here in this election year.
Oh, yes, most definitely. And I think that clearly the Congressional Research Service has already concluded that our government's actions were illegal. And it's amazing that that the White House still has not moved on returning the documents that belong to the Haitian government.
Well, Juan, today we're going to be talking about Latino voting power, and we're joined by three people on the phone from around the country. Lydia Camarillo is executive director of the Southwestern Voter Registration Project in San Antonio. Juan Andrade is national co-chair of Latino Vote USA in Chicago. And Emily Goldfarb is with us from the Northern California Coalition for Immigrant Rights.
Yeah, well, I'd like I'd like to ask Juan Andrade, in terms of Latino Vote USA, if you could tell the listeners a little bit about what the aims of the project are in this critical election year.
Yes, be glad to. Thank you, Juan. Working backwards, our ultimate goal is for November 5 that we have to turn out 5 million Latinos to vote in this election. We've never voted that strong. I think, according to the census, the largest number of Latinos who have ever voted in a single election is 4.2 million. Our goal is to increase that to 5 million, and that is our primary goal, even though it's our third goal. Our second goal is to do what you have already said, to register 1 million additional voters, and we plan to do that through 1,000 nonpartisan campaigns across the country. Many of which have already begun, and we're shifting gears into the next phase here the 1st of June, and then, of course, the home stretch will be after Labor Day. And our first goal, which is actually third in reverse order, is to recruit, organize, and train 20,000 new volunteers to work on this and to help out in this campaign. Over the years, we have trained tens of thousands of community leaders, of grassroots community leaders, to work on electoral participation, to empower themselves and their community. But this is, we're talking about 20,000 fresh troops that for whom many of whom this will be the first national campaign in which they've been involved. And, of course, we're talking largely about young people. And so those are the primary goals of the campaign.
Yeah, I'd like to ask also, Lydia Camarillo in Texas, most listeners don't realize that back in 1960, which you could really call the birth of the modern Latino political power movement, John F. Kennedy was able to eke out a narrow victory in the state of Texas against Richard Nixon by being able to garner 91% of the Mexican-American vote, about 200,000 votes, and was similarly able to win New Mexico by a razor-thin margin on the strength of the Mexican-American vote. To what degree do you suspect that the vote, well, especially in Texas with the recent upset victory of a Latino in the Senate Democratic primary, but also in the general election, do you think will have an impact on the national scene?
Well, obviously, thank you first for the invitation. We have several motivating factors that will bring out the Latino vote. One is obviously when you begin to look at general elections, presidential elections, more people in general come out, and that's the same case for the Latino electorate. But what is exciting about Texas and California as well, but Texas in particular, is that we have in areas where Latinos reside predominantly, like El Paso, the Valley, Bexar County, even Houston, and some parts of Dallas, we have key races that are being challenged, the congressional races by Latinos. For example, in El Paso, we have two Chicanos running against each other on both sides of the ticket, Republican and Democrat. The same in the 23rd District, which is Charlie Jones against Henry Bonilla, the incumbent Republican. And we have a candidate in the Valley, which is predominantly, which is Brownsville, and McAllen in the south of the border,
Lydia,
south of Texas.
Lydia Camarillo, it doesn't sound like you're speaking from your own kitchen, are you?
No, I'm actually in Austin at Las Manitas restaurant talking already and helping to organize some of the communities here. And it's a pleasure to be here, but that's what you hear. And it's a wonderful place where politicians, activists, and the community come. So please join us sometime. But what is exciting about the Texas race, too, is that we have a candidate who, Victor Morales, who decided to run for U.S. Senate with little support of the establishment and anybody else, and won predominantly in those communities where I have just shared. Ultimately, he ended up being the first candidate against three very, very powerful candidates before the runoff, and he ultimately became the candidate for the runoff against John Bryan, who is a congressman. In doing so, he took the top vote twice, and people were absolutely surprised. But when you look at the analysis, it was the Latino communities, El Paso, the Valley, Bexar County, Houston, primarily where the communities where he was able to take the victory by over 9,000 votes.
So the Latino community really defeated the Democratic Party in Texas.
Well, I don't know that he defeated it, but what I think is the issue is that the Latinos are truly going to play a role in this election, and they're going to be part of deciding the future. If we look at the state, there is about 8.9 million registered voters, of which 14% or 1.3 million are Latino. We want to bring it up to 1.5 million, and if we estimate, given how people come out in general elections, that's about 60% of the vote. That'll be about 5 million. We estimate that about 1 million will be Latino. That'll be a very deciding factor. Plus, we will have we already have several organizing efforts. We started in September, and we had voter registrations in El Paso, in San Antonio, in the Valley, in McAllen, all the areas where Latinos are predominant. We also had GOTV activities, and that's what brought out we had GOTV projects, which brought out the communities. So we are not banking that the Latino community is going to come out just because of this excitement. That is, those are motivating factors. We are also being very strategic about ensuring that, in effect, we help the process by having organized efforts and working closely with the communities.
I'd like to ask Emily Goldfarb in Northern California, what impact, for instance, the Immigration and Reform and Control Act and the legalization of some 2.6 million, I think it was, Latin Americans some years back, who now obviously are increasingly eligible now to vote. What impact this is going to have, as well as the scare tactic of the anti-immigration movement in terms of propelling many more naturalized Latin Americans to get citizenship and to vote. What impact all this is having on voter participation among Latinos?
Well, I think the combination of those factors is having a huge impact, both on the numbers of people who are now naturalizing, and as we talked about before, I mean, there's been an increase in 1995 of over 500% compared to 1991 in terms of the rates of naturalization. So one thing is just sort of a natural chronology, like you described, people who adjusted their status through IRCA in 1986 are now ready to become citizens, and I think we would have seen that whether there was anti-immigrant backlash or not. But the combination now of things like Proposition 187 and all the immigration bills that are going through Congress mean that people are not only adjusting their status because they're scared at rates unlike we've ever seen before, but they want to become politically active. So it's now gone way beyond. If there hadn't been the anti-immigrant climate that we've been seeing for the last 2 years, I think we still would have seen large numbers of people becoming citizens, but I don't think we would have seen the same interest in people then turning their citizenship into real opportunities for political power.
You're listening to Emily Goldfarb with the Northern California Coalition for Immigrant Rights. Also, we're joined by Juan Andrade, the national co-chair of Latino Vote USA in Chicago. And the noise you hear in the background is the background where Lydia Camarillo is, in a restaurant where they're organizing voters. She's with the Southwestern Voter Registration Project in San Antonio. I wanted to follow up with Emily. Emily, can you talk a little about your work, particularly when immigrants are sworn in as citizens of this country?
Sure. I mean, we've been having an incredibly successful and exciting voter registration and civic participation campaign here in the Bay Area, starting in about August of last year, 1995. We were given permission by the INS and the local courts here to become the official registrar of voters at the swearing-in ceremonies. And I don't know how many of you or your listeners are familiar with those ceremonies, but especially now, given the huge numbers of people adjusting, they're just these enormous events. In San Francisco, there are about 1,700 people. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again.
Hello.
Sorry, Emily. Just have a little problem with the phones, I think. Lydia, are you still there, by the way, in Texas? No, I didn't think so. Lydia hung up because of the amount of noise in the background. Go on and describe what you were saying, Emily.
Okay, sorry about that. So up until this month, there had been about 1,700 people every other week who had been being sworn in. And out of those 1,700 people, we've been able to register about 1,000 people directly. The swearing-in ceremonies are about to double just this month, which means there'll be about 6,800 people just in San Francisco becoming new citizens, and we hope to be registering at least half of them. It's an incredible event. The degree of motivation on the part of the people who are swearing in that day is just unbelievable. I don't know, I'm sure some of your listeners who have done all sorts of voter registration with respect to different political campaigns over the years, we've all had sort of the dreary experience of standing outside supermarkets and street corners trying to get people to register, and we know that pretty often they just shine us on and wish we would get out of their way. And at these swearing-in ceremonies, it's just an entirely different experience. People come rushing up to our core of volunteers. We usually have about 20 volunteers at each ceremony, and are just so anxious to be able to register. And the moment they register, sort of their next question very eagerly is, what can I do now, and can I vote now, and when is the next election? So we, you know, there's so much energy, there's so much activism, like I said, not only for people to become citizens, for, like you said earlier, I mean, they're primarily doing that both for some of the old-fashioned reasons why people want to become citizens, but also because they're scared to death and think this is the only way they can protect themselves and maintain any kinds of rights or protections in this country.
Yeah,
but
I'd
they're
like
clearly
to ask
also
there, Emily,
doing it so they can be active.
Emily, I'd like to ask Juan Andrade in the Midwest to tell us a little bit in terms of what that backlash or reaction, what impact that has had on Latino voter participation and changing the political climate in the Midwest, where for so many years you directed the Midwest Voter Registration Education Project.
Right. And in fact, I still do. I'm just national co-chair of Latino Vote USA, but I'm still president of Midwest Northeast Voter Registration. Here in the Midwest, particularly Chicago, if you can take that as an example, even though it's not typical of the Midwest, the upsurge, the increase, dramatic increase, phenomenal increase in the naturalization process here, where hundreds and hundreds of new citizens are being sworn in every single week without exception. But the INS is just simply not able to keep up, you know, with the process because they're understaffed or underfunded or whatever excuse they want to use. The fact of the matter is we have 60,000 Latinos here in Chicago waiting to be sworn in so they can complete their naturalization process and register and vote. That process is moving very slowly, but we do hope and we are optimistic that it'll be completed by the 7th of October, which is the registration deadline here in Illinois, so that we can add tens of thousands of additional Latino voters to the polls and prepare them to register to vote in the November 5 general election. And across other cities, in Cleveland and Detroit and Kansas City and Milwaukee and many other cities across the country, there, you know, in Wichita even, Kansas, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of non-citizens who have applied for naturalization and are in the process of completing that now. And we hope that they will do so as well before the October 7 deadline and be able to register in the November 5 election.
And is your sense when you talk to these folks that this is, in essence, a backlash against this incredible right-wing resurgence and anti-immigrant, anti-Latino movement in the country? That they've got to do something?
Yes. You're absolutely right, Juan. That is exactly what is happening because there's nothing like self-interest to motivate voters. Oftentimes we appeal to their civic-mindedness and things like that, patriotism, whatnot. But there's nothing like self-interest to motivate people to act, to do things, to take their future into their own hands, and to take control of their own lives and their quality of life and their well-being, et cetera. And when non-citizens began to see this anti-Latino agenda moving aggressively through the halls of Congress, through legislatures across the country, through cities in America, they said, you know, we've got to, protect ourselves. We have to improve our status. And we have to become naturalized citizens, and we must register and vote entirely out of self-interest. It may sound selfish, but the long end of the fact of the matter is that's why the rest of us vote. And immigrants are no different. And as they are naturalizing, becoming naturalized citizens, and registering and preparing to vote because it is in their interest to do so.
Juan Andrade, we're going to come back to this discussion in a minute. Juan Andrade is National Co-Chair of Latino Vote USA. And by the way, we're going to give out some phone numbers at the end of this segment. Emily Goldfarb is with us from the Northern California Coalition for Immigrant Rights. And we were joined by Lydia Camarillo, Executive Director of Southwestern Voter Registration Project in San Antonio. You're listening to Democracy Now! Juan and I will be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Juan Gonzalez, a columnist at the Daily News, is joining us in New York. And joining us on the telephone, we've got Juan Andrade, National Co-Chair of Latino Vote USA, based in Chicago. It's been billed the most ambitious nonpartisan voter registration drive in the history of Hispanics in America. And Emily Goldfarb is with us from the Northern California Coalition for Immigrant Rights. In just a minute, we're going to be going to a debate on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. We're going to be looking at Israel and Lebanon. But I was wondering, Emily Goldfarb from California, if you could talk a little more about Proposition 187, as they say in California, and how it affects things in California and how you see it affecting things around the country.
Sure. And I also want to give you an example of what a difference we think that the new voting rates among Latino immigrants can make with respect to something like Prop 187. As people know, Prop 187 isn't being implemented in California. But unfortunately, what has happened is exactly what we predicted, is that it immediately unleashed just a wave of devastating anti-immigrant legislation at the federal level, targeting both legal immigrants and illegal immigrants. And just yesterday in the Senate, a bill that primarily deals with undocumented immigration but also would have a devastating impact on legal immigrants was passed in the Senate by 97-3. So the passage of Prop 187 in California is having a national impact and on immigrants of all status. And as we also said, these kinds of things are really mobilizing new citizen voters. I want to just give you one example of what a difference we think that these voting rates can mean in terms of political power in California. When Proposition 187 was passed, this is what the electorate looked like. People of color were 47% of California's population, but they were only 19% of the electorate. Whites in California, who make up only 53% of the population here, represented 81% of the electorate. So that discrepancy between the people who exercise the greatest degree of power in California and the people who are becoming nearly the majority of people in California is what's really led to these very lopsided power dynamics. So if we can really bring up the numbers like we're talking about, Proposition 187 was carried by only 1.5 million votes in 1994, and with the new rates of naturalization and voter registration, if Proposition 187 were on the ballot this November, we're quite sure it would be defeated just by new Latino voters themselves.
But that is also assuming how those voters will cast their ballots, because generally speaking, historically, Latinos have been about a third registering as Republicans and two-thirds as Democrats. I'd like to ask whether Juan Andrade or Emily, whether in the registration processes you've been involved in, you've seen any change in that general composition of the registration figures or whether more are registering as independents.
Well, let me just one thing. That rate, during Proposition 187, 77% of Latino voters voted against 187. So sort of using that same number, that's what it would look like today. And our statistics are showing, I think, pretty similar to what you just said, Juan. It seems to be about two-thirds Democrat, less than one-third Republicans, and in the middle, people undecided. And generally, I think it's because they don't have enough information about the parties. Most commonly, when we're registering Latino voters, the first question they ask when they're trying to figure out what party they want to register for is, well, tell me what's the party of Governor Wilson. That's the party I don't want to register for. Mm-hmm. And you can see, therefore, what a difference Proposition 187 has made with respect to partisanship among Latinos just in California.
Well, what about in the Midwest, Juan?
We see it as well, it has been consistently true over the last 20 years or so that it's about, as you said, one-third and two-thirds. I would be surprised this year if it did not move closer to 75-25 or even 80-20, quite honestly, because of some of the reasons that we've already discussed and what Emily was alluding to with the effects of 187 and copycat legislation in other states and, of course, and because of the wave of anti-Latino and anti-immigrant legislation moving through Congress. This type of legislation and sentiment is clearly being identified with one party more so than the other, and I think this will cause a backlash in the Republican Party, where this is driving more Latinos, at least for this election, into the Democratic Party side, and of course, and Democratic candidates for Congress, for U.S. Senate, and for the presidency as well, obviously, will benefit from this strong move towards the Democratic Party candidates in this particular election. That is not to say, though, that our partisanship is shifting and in a way that's going to remain or hold true for future elections. In this particular election, I think we can expect to see at least a shift of 10 to 15 percent of the vote moving closer to the Democratic Party than away from the Republican Party.
Juan, does Latino Vote USA get money from the Democratic Party?
No. And I would say this, though, that I think is very important, and I don't know how much time we have left, so I want to make sure that we say this, that, while as important as partisanship is to this whole process, because after all, it's Democrats or Republicans that win or lose, how the Latino community votes will impact whether Democrats or Republicans win or lose. But what's important to me and what's important to us as Latinos and the Latino Vote campaign is that the Latino community must win in this election. And the way we win is not determined by whether Democrats or Republicans win, but how many of us participate in the electoral process. That's how we're going to gain respect for our community. The immigrant bashing that you see going on today and the anti-Latino agenda moving through Congress is driven by this lack of respect for the Latino community. And they could care less if we're Democrats or Republicans. Republicans know that there's a number of Hispanic Republicans that they have in their party, and Democrats do too. But the whole issue, this whole movement is being driven by a lack of respect, a blatant lack of respect for Latinos, for our human rights, for our civil rights, and that's exactly what is happening. And what this election is about is a defining moment for the Latino community, where we will stand up and fight, not for Democrats or Republicans, but that we will fight for respect. We will fight for the dignity that we deserve. And that we need in this country.
Juan Andrade, we're going to have to wrap up, but I do want to give out some phone numbers. What is your phone number? And then Emily Goldfarb, how can you be contacted?
Well, for our New York and North and Midwest offices, the easiest number to call is our toll-free number, 1-800-959-5151.
That's 1-800-959-5151. And Emily Goldfarb of the Northern California Coalition for Immigrant Rights?
Yeah, our number is area code 415-243-8215.
Well, I want to thank you both, Emily Goldfarb and Juan Andrade, National Co-Chair of Latino Vote USA, for joining us today. We'll certainly be following the Latino vote as we go through the months. And Juan Gonzalez, thanks for being with us from New York.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amy, and have a good weekend.
You too.
You.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, a debate on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East.
You have devoted yourselves to strengthening the bonds between the United States and Israel, a cornerstone of our foreign policy and of our efforts to advance peace and freedom and democracy in the Middle East.
President Clinton addressing AIPAC earlier this week, the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee. He was the first sitting president to address their policy conference. He was there with Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres. He was also there following the Israeli attack on a UN compound in southern Lebanon, killing more than 100 Lebanese civilians, and the number seems to be mounting now. Clinton sent in Secretary of State Warren Christopher, who brokered an agreement between Israel and Lebanon. As Clinton says, Israel is a centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy. When Israeli Prime Minister came to Washington this week, he met both with President Clinton, and Peres met with Senator Dole as well. Yasser Arafat also met with the president. The Clinton administration takes credit for the Middle East peace process, the signings taking place on the White House lawn. Israel receives more U.S. military and foreign aid than any other country, and together with Egypt, receives well over half of U.S. foreign aid. This makes the Middle East a concern to voters, taxpayers, and people who care about peace in the world. In our journalist roundtable, which we try to do as much as we can on Fridays, we're joined by two reporters. Serge Schmaiman is the New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem. He's been there for about 8 months. Robert Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, a British newspaper in Beirut. He was just voted Best Foreign Reporter of the Year by British editors and has won the Johns Hopkins Prize for International Reporting. He would have received that last week, but instead of being in Washington, he was the first reporter into the bombed UN base in Qana, southern Lebanon. I want to start by asking about the aims of Israel and Lebanon. Robert Fisk, you've described it as an offensive war. Serge Schmaiman of The New York Times, you say it's defensive. Can you explain why?
I have not really described it as a defensive war. I haven't used that phrase. It was an operation that was designed to achieve certain political ends. It was a political operation whose goal was to persuade Syria to rein in the Hezbollah guerrillas who operate in South Lebanon and who've been shelling northern Israel. From the Israeli point of view, they felt, whether this is justified or not is another issue, that these guerrillas were operating beyond a 1993 ceasefire agreement in their activities. And so they launched this operation in order to compel Syria to get that agreement rewritten.
Mm-hmm. Your paper, of course, the New York Times, says Israel has every right to defend itself from terrorist threats. This is in a recent editorial, and that Israel's, quote, desirable and legitimate objective and sound policy is to use force against those who shelter terrorists.
That's the editorial policy. But from this point of view, as I say, it's not my job is not to determine whether this was legitimate or justifiable, but to try to understand why they did it. And the logic here, there were several sets of arguments. One was the logic that the old agreement had expired and it was time to lean on Syria to create a new one. There was also the fact that Israel was still reeling from a series of suicide bombings, and there was an incredible mood in the population that we have to do something, we have to lash out, we have to strike. And, of course, there was Shimon Peres, who has an election campaign in his hands, and under this pressure needed to demonstrate that he is a tough leader on issues of security. I think what he had intended at the outset was something of a surgical strike that would create certain hardships within Lebanon, but not necessarily a lot of casualties, and would force Syria to rein in these guerrillas.
Would you agree with what you wrote on April 17th, that Israel's primary goal is to end rocket attacks into northern Israel?
That was the end goal, because I think they realized from the outset that militarily this was not possible without a very large operation. Katyusha rockets are very mobile. People can carry them from one place to another, and there was no way that they were going to get them all without a fairly large ground operation. So their goal was to stop the rocket attacks, but the real goal was to get Syria to do that, because they felt that Syria has the ability to turn these guerrillas on and off, and what they wanted to do was to demonstrate to Syria that there will be a heavy price if it continues allowing these guerrillas to operate.
Robert Fisk of the British newspaper The Independent, you have described Israel's intentions in Lebanon in a very different way in the newspaper. Tell us what you have seen on the ground in Lebanon.
I've seen what I can only describe, because I had the misfortune to see a lot of it with my own eyes, as the mass slaughter of civilians. My calculations show that approaching 170, possibly as many as 200, because many corpses have still not been identified from the Qana massacre, that we have up to 200 civilians dead, and on my record here, approximately 11 Hezbollah guerrillas. The idea that by destroying the infrastructure of Lebanon, by attacking its power stations in Christian areas which have nothing at all to do with the Hezbollah, as well as the repeated attacks on civilians, so many that to call each one an accident beggars belief, is a deliberate attempt to smash Lebanon, to make it weak enough to make a separate peace with Israel, while it remains in occupation of the southern part, the southernmost strip of territory, of the Lebanese territory, and thus further isolate Syria, whose progress in the eyes of the Israelis towards the kind of peace Israel wants with Syria has not been quick enough to suggest that the Hezbollah, who have proved themselves, unfortunately for Israel, to be a highly efficient guerrilla movement, to suggest that this massive technological firepower, courtesy of your taxpayers, thank goodness not of me, is going to in some way stop Katyusha rockets, which, as Serge rightly says, are highly mobile, small, easily maneuverable, easily transportable weapons, is preposterous. What I've seen with my own eyes proves this to be the case. Indeed, driving back through the southern villages only a few hours ago, because I've been returning to Qana and the other villages there, I've seen Hezbollah men in almost all those villages, only attending the funerals of civilians, certainly not attending any of their own, and clearly still in control of all the areas which Israel was supposedly intending to drive them out of. So as a military operation, it failed. As a political operation, it failed, because it did not produce anything other than a written version of the 1993 agreement. And it is a fact that under that agreement, both the Israelis and the Hezbollah, while insisting that they will not fire from or at civilian targets, are still permitted in the occupied Israeli area in southern Lebanon and to the north of it to go on fighting each other. And indeed, four mortars in the last 24 hours have been fired by the Hezbollah at Israeli occupation troops. So all this bloodbath, which I've, as I say, had the misfortune of actually witnessing with my own eyes in the case of Qana, has been apparently to put us back to the 1993 status quo, has not succeeded in getting Syria to do anything so exotic as leaning on the Hezbollah, and indeed has apparently produced the grotesque irony that all these people had to be cut down and killed, almost all of them civilians, so that Mr. Peres can get re-elected and thus bring peace to the Middle East. I am lost for words at such an equation.
We're talking to Robert Fisk, who is the Middle East correspondent based in Beirut, Lebanon, who was the first reporter into the Qana camp, the UN base, after the Israelis attacked it. We're also talking to Serge Schmemann, who is the bureau chief for the New York Times based in Jerusalem. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman, and in this continuation of our journalist roundtable, we continue to be joined by Serge Schmaiman, who is the bureau chief of the New York Times based in Jerusalem, and Robert Fisk, who is the Middle East correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent. He's based in Beirut, Lebanon, and has been covering what has happened in the Khana UN camp since the Israeli attack. He has been there almost every day. Now, before we go on to the results, the agreement that was brokered by Warren Christopher between Israel and Lebanon, I did want to step back for a minute to Robert Fisk and to that question of whether Israel is defending itself in this war, which is very much the characterization not only of the New York Times, but of most of the media in this country, I would say, whether you believe that to be the truth.
Look, I've noticed in the American coverage that history starts the moment the Hezbollah Katyushas land in Galilee, and then Israel responds in defense of itself by pouring this 23,000 shells, 600 airstrikes, I've lost count of the bombardment on Lebanon. That is not what happened. Since 1993, when this original agreement was brokered after an almost identically savage bombardment of civilians. 123 died in that occasion, and almost identically the same number of Hezbollah, 11. There have been a series of very serious incidents inside southern Lebanon, usually incidents in which Lebanese civilians have been killed by fire directed at them from Israeli positions inside the occupied part of southern Lebanon. I've got a list in front of me from my own files of approximately 20 incidents of this kind, 12 of which I covered myself. In 1994, for example, in the village of Nabati Afa'a, seven people, civilians, including three women, were killed by flechette shells fired from a Merkava tank, an Israeli Merkava tank inside southern Lebanon. No reason was given for that attack. The Israelis said there would be a military inquiry. I understand there was not. In the nearby village of Nabati Tahta, a little later, 12 members of two families, including children, were killed when an Israeli aircraft bombed their house. The Israelis said it was an accident. In 1995, a girl of 12, Amal Maruni, had her legs blown off by an Israeli mortar in the village of Shakra. She bled to death outside her house. A few months later, a 17-year-old woman, Jemana Fahas, killed by an Israeli mortar shell in the same village. In 1996, we've had two construction workers on a water tower in the village of Yatta killed by a TOW missile fired from an Israeli position. A few days later, 3 weeks ago, a teenager killed in Bradsheet by a bomb, which the Hezbollah claimed was left by the Israelis. In each of these incidents, the Hezbollah retaliated, with the exception of one incident, and that was Nabatea. The Hezbollah retaliated by firing Katyushas into Israel, claiming that the 1993 agreement had been broken and that the Israelis should not have shelled civilians. In several of the cases where the Israelis clearly did shell these villages and kill civilians, it followed attacks on their military positions by the Hezbollah. And what lies at the base of this is Israeli occupation. Since July of 1993, 61 Israeli soldiers have been killed in southern Lebanon by an increasingly efficient and ferocious Hezbollah. The Israelis retaliated by shelling the villages. They then killed civilians. The Hezbollah retaliated with Katyusha fire, and Israel then said it had to defend itself. And it was the last of those incidents, the one in Bradsheet, where the teenager was killed by the bomb, which led to the Katyusha fire into Galilee, which allegedly provoked the so-called Operation Grapes of Wrath. Now, as you can see, history is much more complicated than just the story of people in Galilee who suddenly find wicked Hezbollah men firing Katyushas at them. Naturally enough, Arabs regard their own living human beings as being as precious as the Israelis do. And that's an understandable attitude. Now, whether or not you regard Hezbollah as being manipulated by Syria, and to some extent, of course it is, it's a weapon in Assad's hands, it is nonetheless a resistance movement. They are Lebanese people fighting Israeli occupation. And until there have been incidents of Lebanese civilians killed, with two exceptions, which were rogue attacks, and they were very small, and I don't think it was even hardly a complaint from Israel, those Katyushas have always been fired into Galilee in response to the killing by Israeli forces of civilians in Lebanon. And I've gone through the files, I've been out on the, I've reported on the ground on these stories, I cannot get around these facts. And to regard and to promote Operation Grapes of Wrath, the very title astonishes me, from the Book of Deuteronomy of all places, to regard this as being justified defense and being proportionate is, I mean, if I'm to believe that, I have to believe there are fairies at the bottom of my garden. This was clearly a political operation, to use Serge's words. It was a political operation that totally failed, that was utterly savage, and that caused a massacre the like of which we, who have reported in Lebanon for a long time, have not seen since Sabra and Shatila, when Israel's Christian phalangist allies massacred hundreds of Palestinians while Israeli soldiers around the camps watched on.
You're listening to Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent. Serge Schmemann of The New York Times, do you dispute this history that Robert Fisk has just laid out?
I don't dispute the facts, no. I don't dispute that there have been unequal incidents, that there has been, Israel obviously has the far greater firepower and has done the far greater damage. From my perspective and from what I do, I don't see myself as trying to pass judgment or to say whether this was a great horror or not. In our division of responsibility, that's more the responsibility of the op-ed page. And so I don't want to get into an argument over whether this was justified, not justified, whether it's politically viable, not viable. The fact of the matter is that in this struggle, there may be totally unequal sides, and there may be totally conflicting justifications. It is a fact that Israel occupies a sliver of land, of territory that is not Israel's, and it's also a fact that it probably will refuse to leave it until there's a comprehensive peace with Syria, with the entire northern front. The problem that exists there is rooted in a conflict that has gone on for many years, and now there is this attempt by the United States, by all the parties here, to find a comprehensive solution to it.
Well, let me ask you something before we get to that comprehensive solution. You write that Israel applied precise and selective force in Lebanon, and you say without critical comment that Israel's officers insisted that the gunners were not aware of the refugees at the Khana refugee camp. So you're definitely conveying an impression that Israel is not targeting civilians. That's very different from what Robert Fisk is describing.
Israel says it did not deliberately target civilians. The bombing at Cana was treated as a major disaster here. Obviously, it was a disaster. Their intention had been to create a wave of refugees fleeing north and then to shell the southern towns where they purported that Hezbollah was operating. But I'm telling you, I was not there. I'm telling you what the position here was, and also that when this place was hit, the UN camp at Cana, that there was an incredible reaction here. I mean, people were horrified. It changed the entire tone of this operation. Thereafter, the effort was to try to end it. The debate was how to end it. Christopher came in, and the entire drive behind it took a totally different shape.
Robert Fisk, you write that UN witnesses saw a pilotless Israeli reconnaissance drone taking photographs of the compound as the slaughter went on, saying that Israel knew exactly who they were killing.
Well, I think there are three vital pieces of evidence which the Israelis have not been able to respond to satisfactorily. The first is that 19 hours before the slaughter at Khana, United Nations officials told the deputy to General Amnon Lifkin-Shahak, the chief of staff, that there were refugees in every one of the UN locations across southern Lebanon. Secondly, the drone was clearly seen in the air throughout the attack by UN soldiers, whom I have personally spoken to. And indeed, a few hours ago...
A drone is a plane?
A drone is a pilotless aircraft, the MK. The Israelis use them frequently over southern Lebanon. They don't obviously lose men if they get shot down, so it's a very wise precaution on the part of the Israelis. The United Nations possess a video film which shows the shelling of the Khana camp, and over the top of the soundtrack is heard the drone, which is a buzzing sound like a rather angry bee. Indeed, many of the refugees who survived but were badly wounded remembered hearing this drone in the gaps between the shell fire. And the soldiers I spoke to today physically pointed to where they saw it in the sky, which was directly over the camp. So we have the UN warning the Israelis that it is there. We have the drone overhead. And then we have the fact that after all the boasts and promises of the precision targeting, the super technology that would prevent any kind of civilian damage, that this shelling went on long after the United Nations from UNIFIL Operations Office in Nakuru were pleading for it to stop. We reckon 12 minutes, a minimum of 12 shells into the compound. I'm looking at, as I speak, at photographs of the shells actually bursting on the Fijian compound at the moment of massacre, taken from a nearby hill by a soldier. And you can clearly see it is a bright, clear day, and there are white, fluffy clouds in the background. The Israelis say that it was overcast, and they couldn't see from the drone what the shells were hitting. It does not accord with the facts, as I am looking at them physically on these photographs taken by a soldier, which I've just had developed here in front of me.
Response, Serge Maimon, does this surprise you? Does this in any way jive with what you've learned inside of Israel?
I would not understand why Israel would deliberately hit any civilians. It would have, you know, looking at this as an operation with very specific aims. Again, we can argue the merits, and we can argue this very strongly, obviously. It's a very powerful and brutal action. But within the realm of what might be the various goals Israel may be pursuing, certainly killing civilians was not one of them. They responded to artillery fire at every possible chance, and probably, as they say, I see no reason why this was not so, that their gunners responded far too fast before the whatever intelligence they had. I don't know about this drone. It's the first time I've heard about it. I have no reason to dispute that, but I see it as a hasty and totally disastrous reaction. But I just cannot understand why or how this would be done deliberately. I can't see any conceivable purpose that would serve, you know, apart from the horror of such a possibility.
Robert Fisk, from your experience in Lebanon, do you think this is meant to serve a purpose?
Look, I'll say two things briefly. This incident was not in isolation. Only hours before Kana, an Israeli helicopter gunship had fired an American laser-guided missile into a house, killing nine people. The youngest of them, of one family, was a four-day-old baby. Shortly before that, we had an attack on an ambulance, which four children and two women were killed. Shortly before that, we had a two-year-old girl decapitated by a helicopter, Israeli helicopter-fired missile in South Beirut. Shortly before that, we had a 27-year-old woman killed by a missile fired by a helicopter next to the GA power station, not to mention two entire power stations, into one of which Israeli jets fired 20 missiles. If that isn't attacks on civilians, I mean, what, if one can accept that one or two are mistakes, what are the rest? What can the Lebanese respond when they hear that these are all accidents? Indeed, are they all accidents? From a reporter on the ground who has to go and see these things, I cannot explain them all as accidents. I cannot physically do that. I do not believe in fairies at the bottom of my garden. If we are asked to believe that all these, and I've only just given you a few of the civilian casualties, that all these acts were by accident, either the Israelis have the most inefficient army in the Middle East, or it is intentional. I do not wish to believe it is the second, but I ask myself what I am to believe when I see these terrible deeds and I see the results of them with my own eyes. This was clearly a war against civilians. It deliberately drove 500,000 refugees out. The fact that I am sitting here now in semi-darkness is because the Israelis attacked a power station in a Christian area, for heaven's sakes. To regard this as a war against guerrillas is preposterous.
Robert Fisk and Serge Maimon, we just have 2 minutes to go, and I do want to get to the agreement, which you both characterize very differently.
You've put me in the position of and of my articles of some of defending the Israeli action, of justifying the Israeli action. I think this entire debate has been formed a little artificially. I have not been in South Lebanon. It was not my job
to cover what was going on there. It was not my job here to justify, criticize, or even assess what Israel was doing. I'm a reporter. I'm not a columnist. I'm not an editorial writer. We had a reporter in Lebanon. You can compare notes with him. So, you know, you are framing this as if somehow I am debating and defending a certain operation. I am not. I have my own opinions about them. I've kept them to myself, and I will keep them to myself because, you know, in our newspaper, there is a distinction between what a reporter does and what a columnist does. So I don't want to be left in this position of somehow standing here in a debate in which we're trying to figure out who's to blame for something.
Well, let me ask you something. This is an election show that you're on now, Democracy Now! How do you think the events of the last week, what the United States' role in Israel and Lebanon overall, how do you think that will play into the presidential elections in November?
Into the American presidential elections?
Yes, and Israel's, if you'd like to comment since you're there.
In Israel, at this stage, the Israeli election is on May 29th. It's a very volatile election. There is a block of undecided voters for whom the two sides are competing very fiercely. If the election was held today, probably Shimon Peres would win. But unfortunately, or fortunately, things here change very rapidly. So whatever wisdom there is today, tomorrow, it could all dissipate. But at this stage, his appearance of toughness, his continuation with the withdrawal, the Palestinian decision to lift certain aspects from their covenant, all this has played a bit into Paris's hands. Very little, though. The percentages here have been changing very little currently, and at this stage he has a lead of about 5 points, which is very narrow and could change very dramatically.
Robert Fisk, you've been following the U.S. press, although you are based in Lebanon. What do you think President Clinton's aims are in this election year with what he's doing in Lebanon and Israel right now?
Well, first of all, I don't think that events in Lebanon will have the slightest effect on Mr. Clinton's election campaign unless Mr. Peres loses the election in Israel, which, of course, he may do, not least because of the outcome of this particular military operation. I'd like to say I sympathize very much with what Serge says. He's not on the ground in southern Lebanon. He's in Jerusalem, and I don't think it's fair to expect him to have all the information that we have available to us here. I would, however, think it's important just to refer back to one quotation which was given to the French newspaper Le Monde in an interview on the 1st of January this year, which was published in Le Monde on the 3rd of January, in which the Israeli Foreign Affairs Minister, Ehud Barak, said that if there were further attacks by Hezbollah against Israel, he replied, he said, if Israel reacts militarily, it will be against Lebanon and the victims will be Lebanese. I think that pretty much accords with what I've seen here.
Robert Fisk, Serge Shmaiman, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Robert Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, a British daily based in Beirut. He was just voted the best foreign reporter of the year by British editors. And Serge Shmaiman is the New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem. You're listening to Democracy Now! And as we have a minute, a few follow-ups on some stories we did earlier this week. The Senate has overwhelmingly passed a bill that would crack down on illegal immigrants at the border and the workplace and stiffen rules on legal immigrants. By voice vote, the Senate approved an amendment to make female genital mutilation a federal crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison, but it would not make the threat of such mutilation a basis for an asylum claim. Now, earlier this week on Wednesday, you heard Fauzia Kasinga. She's a 19-year-old woman from Togo, and she told her story here on Democracy Now! About what happened to her in Togo, why she fled that country. She feared that she would have to undergo FGM, female genital mutilation. Well, her case was heard by an immigration appeals board yesterday. The government asked an immigration board to set a standard that would grant asylum to women facing genital mutilation only in extreme cases that would shock the conscience. And the case is expected to set a national precedent for women in this country, particularly African and Middle Eastern women who seek U.S. asylum to escape FGM. We look forward to hearing your calls, especially on debates that you hear on Democracy Now! You can call us at 202-588-0988, extension 313. That's 202-588-0988, extension 313. And we want to say goodbye to Linda Aguiano, a fond farewell, our sales and marketing director. We want to thank her for her efforts over the years to keep Pacifica stations informed about national programming. Tune in Monday for another edition of Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.